Hey everyone, welcome to this bonus episode of Home in Progress, sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. And on the last episode, the last official episode, we dug into the rise and the decline of Victorian-era architecture. And it's a huge story with a ton of interesting things to cover. And I did my best to focus on what I thought were the key aspects of the story. But one big part of it that I was forced to skim over, and it really bummed me out, was the story of the fire at the Palace of Westminster and the working relationship of Augustus Pugin and Charles Barry. Now, this fire and the resulting collaboration between those two, the architect and the idealist, all of that kind of set the template for how Victorian architects would think about style, about ornament, and the relationship between the past and the present. You know, it's kind of where the philosophical foundation for all of the Victorian abundance that we think about when we think about Victorian-era architecture, this is where all of that really crystallized into something, you know, tangible. So today we're going to look at all of that in detail in this bonus episode. And since I don't really have time constraints here, normally Home in Progress, you're hearing it as a podcast, but it airs as a radio show on a local station out in Holland, Michigan. And I've got time constraints. So a lot of the times I have to cram things into certain spaces and I've got to cut stuff. Today, I don't have to do that. I can kind of ramble and just take my time to get there. So I want to focus on this fire. It started on October 16 of 1834 and it destroyed the Palace of Westminster in London, you know, the seat of Parliament there. And interestingly enough, I think we can make the argument that the blaze, this big fire, actually started, in a way at least, 700 years earlier. Okay? All those years back, you know, 1100s or so, England is using something called tally sticks to keep its accounting records. And I don't know if you've ever heard of tally sticks before, but they're simply pieces of wood, usually hazel or ash or something like that. And each stick had notches carved into it to show how much money someone owed the crown. All right. So here's the deal. When a debt was issued, the stick was notched accordingly, and then it was split into two pieces. One half went to the royal treasury. The other half went to the person who owed the money. Later, when the debt was paid, the two pieces were matched back together to make sure that everything was paid back in full. Now, because the grain and the notches had to line up perfectly, it was nearly impossible to fake these things. So here are a couple interesting facts with tally sticks before we even get to the fire. When the stick was split into, the longer piece was called the stock, and that one went to the creditor, the person who was owed the money. The shorter piece was called the foil, and that went to the debtor, to the person who owed the money. So if you held the stock, you literally held proof that somebody owed you money. You were a stockholder. All right? Over time, those stocks started to take on a life of their own. People began buying, selling, and trading them, and they kind of became their own source, you know, their own kind of currency. The British government even issued tally sticks, and people would trade them at a discount, basically creating the first bond market. And when the Bank of England opened its doors in 1697, a big chunk of its startup capital came from tally stick stocks. So our entire modern financial system, stocks, bonds, shareholders, all of that, all traces back to these simple notched pieces of wood, tally sticks. All right, really interesting. And here's another fun fact, that old saying, getting the short end of the stick. You know, I've spent my whole life getting the short end of the stick. That idea, that phrase, actually comes from tally sticks because the debtor, the person who owed the money, literally got the shorter piece, the shorter end of the stick. All right, so that's what tally sticks were. And while it sounds really simplistic and primitive, the system worked. And it worked so well that it lasted, you know, 700 or so years, you know, into the early 1800s. And that's when people finally started using paper-based record keeping and written ledgers and stuff like that. Now, the move away from sticks of wood with notches carved on them to paper was generally agreed upon by most people as a solid, solid advancement. But there was still a little problem, just a little inkling of a problem. And they needed to do something with all these piles and piles and piles of obsolete old wooden sticks that were cluttering up the Palace of Westminster. Well, that gets us to our fire. the current clerk of works at the palace in 1834, a man named Richard Whibley. I don't know how to pronounce it. Richard Whibley. That's what we're going to call it. He was a thinker. He was a problem solver, and he went to work and came up with an absolutely brilliant plan. You know, after all, he's looking at these sticks in the basement, and he's thinking, all right, what are we going to do with all these guys? There's a lot of them. You know, they're made of wood. And, you know, after all these years, he's thinking, this is incredibly dry wood. And one thing we all know about dry wood is that it burns. It burns like there's no tomorrow. So Richard Whibley, our clerk of works at the palace, thinks, why not burn all these tally sticks to ash? Right? Ash is a lot easier to deal with than all these tally sticks. That's the surefire way to get them out of here and to free up some space. Yeah, you could toss them out. He thought about that, but that's not as much fun as burning things. You know, just throwing it in the garbage isn't as much fun. And we know that's true, right? You know, raking and bagging leaves, for example. You know, we can do that. We can rake them all up and put them in big bags and put them on the roads, and that's doable. We can make do with that. It works, but it's not fun, right? Not like when we used to be able to make a big pile of leaves and then burn it, you know? Like lighting the beacons of Gondor or something like that. I loved burning leaves. It was a lot more fun. Fall was more fun. Life was more fun when we could burn things to get rid of them. Probably wasn't as healthy. I get that, but it was more fun. So anyway, Richard Whibley, he wants to burn these sticks. So he's going to do that. But not outside in some big uncontrollable bonfire. That's what the commoners might do. You know, he's a man of breeding, and he decided that these tally sticks, royal as they were, should be burned royally right here in the palace's furnaces. And so, without a second thought, the clerk of works tasks a couple of workmen with the job of burning two large, enormous cartloads of sticks in the stoves beneath the floor of the House of Lords. And let me tell you, the guys that he got, they were devoted. You know, they may not have been all that bright. You know, history doesn't tell us for sure, but there are clues. They may not have been all that bright, but they were committed to their work. You know, nothing was going to deter them from finishing this task. And I mean literally nothing. See, they went to work early in the morning of October 16, and they started dumping loads of these sticks into the fires, watching that dry wood ignite almost instantly. So they worked and worked throughout the day, constantly tossing armfuls of sticks into the furnaces. Now, unfortunately, partway through the day, a chimney fire begins to smolder beneath the floor of the House of Lords. You know, out of sight for the workers. They don't see it happening. They don't know what's going on, but it's happening. You know, it starts to smolder, and it continues to smolder for a good part of the day. And honestly, if you'd think that something like that would be noticed by somebody, well, you'd be right. It would be noticed. And in fact, a party of visitors to the House of Lords conducted, you know, brought through by this deputy housekeeper named Mrs. Wright, she's bringing them through, and this party of visitors becomes strangely puzzled by the heat just emanating out of the floor as they're walking over it. That was definitely strange, right? That's not the normal experience here in October, that the floor is hot to the touch. That's odd. But if that wasn't confusing enough, they were absolutely flummoxed. I mean, they had no idea what to do with this when they saw the smoke pouring out of the floor. You know, the floor is hot and it's smoking. What's going on here? This is not usual. Now, we would all know what was going on at that point if we were there and we saw that. But that was happening way before the phrase "where there's smoke, there's fire" had been invented. So they had no idea. The heat and the smoke and its connection to fire completely lost on them. So they puzzled about it for a while, and then good old Mrs. Wright checked with the workmen. But I told you, these people were diligent. You know, I said that right at the beginning. They were committed to their work. They maybe weren't the brightest bulbs, but they were committed. They told their boss they're going to burn these sticks, and they weren't going to quit till they burned them. All of them. So they dismissed Mrs. Wright and her concerns. You know, hot floors with smoke rising from them was clearly not connected to the inferno in the furnaces. There's no causal relationship there at all. Nothing to worry about. So they kept working. Mrs. Wright figured, well, you know, they seem good with it. I guess we might as well just move on with our day. And everything proceeded as it had been going. And then around 5 o'clock or so, the workmen called it a day, put the fires out in the furnaces, and they went home. Mrs. Wright also decided to call it a day, locked things up, and headed out. Soon after that, screams arise from a doorkeeper's wife that the House of Lords is on fire, and then in what seemed like no time at all, the flames spread through the rest of the palace. Huge fireball erupted. You know, it's visible for miles and miles around as more of the building goes up in flames. And thousands of Londoners are crowding around the bridges, around the bank of the Thames, and they're watching as the blaze consumed centuries of history. There's paintings about this. Google it and you can check them out. Now, in the end, both houses of Parliament were completely destroyed, along with most of the surrounding buildings. The only major structure that survived was Westminster Hall, and that was saved by heroic firefighters and a lucky shift in wind that night. Now, by the following morning, October 17, much of the Palace of Westminster, it's in ashes. But out of these ashes came one of the most famous architectural partnerships of the 19th century, and one of the most tragic. The story of Charles Barry and Augustus Pugin and their design for the new Palace of Westminster didn't just give us the iconic Houses of Parliament. It ended up launching the Gothic Revival and helped define what we now call Victorian architecture. Here's the scoop on this part of the story. Now, after Parliament burned down, the government held a design competition for the new building. And the rules were specific. The design had to be either Gothic or Elizabethan. Nothing classical, nothing modern, because Westminster Hall had survived and the new construction needed to be able to blend with that. So it needed to be Gothic or Elizabethan. That was basically the requirement. Now, the winner of this contest was Charles Barry. He's a Westminster-born architect in his 40s at the time, and he's already one of London's rising stars. He'd been born just across the street from where Big Ben now stands, and he was orphaned as a young kid, and he left school, I think it was around 15, the age of 15, and he apprenticed with a surveyor, and before long, he'd earned this reputation for diligence and quiet genius. You know, not saying anything, but I earned a similar reputation amongst people, some people, handful of people. Mom, dad, mom saw the genius and the diligence. But anyway, Charles Barry, you know, people are seeing that he's got, you know, a bright future in front of him. He's got big dreams and they're feeling like he's going to be able to achieve these things. Well, Charles Barry's got a small inheritance. You know, like I said, he was orphaned young, but there is a little bit of money there. And he takes that money and he sets off on a 3-year grand tour through France, Italy, Greece, Egypt, Palestine, you know, all over the place. And those travels really end up changing him. He falls in love with the balance and the grandeur of the Italian Renaissance. And when he came home in 1820, he brought that style, you know, and all the things that he picked up on the road, he brought that with him. His Travelers Club on Pall Mall, built in 1832, that was hailed as the first true Italian Renaissance building in London. Now, by the mid-1830s, Barry was famous for elegant classical designs, palaces in miniature, kind of is the idea. You know, so he's really well known when this contest comes about. But there's a problem. Remember, the rules require a Gothic or Elizabethan style to match the surviving medieval Westminster Hall. Gothic wasn't really Barry's language, so he needed help. And he turned to somebody who spoke Gothic fluently. And that's a brilliant 23-year-old draftsman named Augustus Welby Northmore Pugin. P-U-G-I-N, Pugin. He was already a phenomenon at this point. He's talented, fiery, absolutely consumed by his love for the Gothic. And just that same year, 1834, he had converted to Catholicism. Now, it wasn't a sudden spiritual experience for him. It was something that had been building for years through all of his work. Pugin had been studying the great cathedrals of France. And when he was doing that, while doing that, he became, you know, just absolutely convinced that the medieval Gothic wasn't just more beautiful, it was more truthful. Okay, it's not just more beautiful, it's more truthful. The forms of those old churches, he argued, that those forms expressed the faith that had created them. Every pointed arch lifted the soul towards heaven. That's his idea. Every carved detail was an act of devotion. To Pugin, architecture wasn't decoration, it was theology. And that conviction, that really, really strong belief, which is literally what conviction is, didn't need to clarify, that conviction shaped every single thing he touched. And the irony was really profound here. All right. So here's a young, you know, devout Catholic helping design the seat of Britain's Protestant government just 5 years after Catholics had even been allowed to serve in Parliament. He couldn't even submit designs under his own name, really, because his open, passionate Catholicism would have guaranteed rejection. But Barry understood the genius of Pugin. And so while Barry handled the structure, Pugin kind of quietly supplied the soul of the building. And he worked feverishly, designing not only the huge soaring interiors, but also the carved woodwork, the metal fittings, the tiles, the fabrics, the patterns of the tiles underfoot, the tracery in the windows, even the shape of the inkstands. All of them came from Pugin's imagination. Now, later, letters to his friends show how much he poured into this work and how much it drained him. He called it the hardest labor of his life, but it was also his ministry, because for Pugin, this wasn't just architecture. You know, there's way more going on with the construction of these buildings. To him, it was kind of like evangelism in a way. He believed that beauty was moral. We talked about that in the episode that aired previously. We got a little more into that, but he believed that beauty was moral, that good buildings could shape good people. And so through Barry's official plans, Pugin set out to kind of preach through design to restore, you know, in form and symbol, what he saw as the spiritual heart of England. That's his goal. That's what he's doing. And that's the deep irony of the Palace of Westminster. It's really, really intriguing. It's one of the most enduring symbols of British Protestant democracy. And yet inside, in its details and on the outside, it's profoundly Catholic. Now, however, I mentioned that this collaboration had elements of the tragic in it, right? So let's get to those. Despite all of Pugin's work, we talked about all the things that he did. Despite all of that, Charles Barry actually gave him very little public credit. And it's a little muddy as to why, you know, what his reasoning was. Was he being selfish? Was he just protecting the project and protecting both of them? It's really hard to say. You know, on the one hand, he gave Pugin a way to contribute to the cause in a safe manner. Remember, we talked about if it was clear to everybody that this new Catholic convert was involved, he probably would have been, you know, potentially kicked off the project. So in one regard, Charles Barry's giving Pugin a way to contribute safely. You know, he's kind of giving him some architectural cover so that he can collaborate with Barry. But on the other hand, the only official title Pugin ever was given was Superintendent of Wood Carving, you know, a description that came nowhere close to covering what he actually did. Well, despite this, despite the fact that Barry wasn't dishing out the credit, by the mid-1840s, people were beginning to whisper that Pugin really was the real architect of Parliament. And the rumors grew loud enough and rampant enough and fervent enough that Pugin himself came out and issued a public statement saying, "Hey, no, I'm only assisting Mr. Barry. All of my work is just based on his designs." So he's trying to calm things down and move things forward, you know, keep things moving forward. Well, all of this drama added a huge amount of pressure to the work. And then on top of that all, Parliament themselves get involved and micromanages every single design decision that needs to be made. So they're there micromanaging everything. They're blaming Charles Barry for every single delay that crops up, even though most of those delays were caused by their own demands. And then when the House of Commons chamber was finally finished in 1850, the members of Parliament, they walk in, they look it over and they say, "Nah, we hate it." They complained about the layout. They complained about the acoustics, and they forced Barry to redesign the whole thing. He had to love working with these people. We know that he didn't, because all of this pressure took a terrible toll on both of the men. You know, Pugin, let's look at him first. He was juggling dozens of projects. He was juggling over 100 churches, country houses, furniture designs, metalwork, wallpaper, tiles. He was doing a ton of different things while working on Westminster. And by 1852, his health completely collapsed. He suffered a complete mental and physical breakdown after years of relentless overwork, and he was committed to bedlam. Right. The infamous Bedlam Asylum. And after 5.5 weeks there, he was released, but he never really recovered. And he ended up dying on September 14, 1852, at just 40 years old. never seen the palace completed. Now, Barry, he didn't really fare all that much better. While he's managing Westminster's construction, you know, he's dealing with Parliament's constant interference. They're micromanaging, they're constant nagging. While he's doing that, he's also designing the Reform Club. He's working on projects from Istanbul to Scotland. He reportedly slept only 4 or 5 hours a night, you know, rising between 4 and 6 in the morning to get to work again. Well, doing that day after day, on top of all the stress that each one of those projects brought him, all of that aged him terribly. And on May 12, 1860, after spending an afternoon at the Crystal Palace with his wife, he was seized with difficulty breathing and chest pain. And then later he died of a heart attack that night at his home. He was 64 years old and the palace still wasn't finished. His son Edward completed the work in 1870, 34 years after construction began. Now, neither of the brilliant minds who created it lived to see their masterpiece completed. So that was tragic, right? But it gets worse. Remember when I mentioned that Barry said Pugin was the superintendent of woodworking and how that really didn't explain the depth of his role in the least? Well, nobody ever corrected that story, at least not while both men were alive. After their deaths, their sons end up fighting bitterly over who deserved the greater share of the glory. And that feud dragged on for decades. And it wasn't until after World War II, nearly 100 years later, that Pugin's name finally appears in the official guidebook to the Houses of Parliament. Today, historians generally agree Barry provided the grand plan and oversaw construction. Pugin filled it with soul. So why does all of this matter? You know, why spend time on a fire, two architects and one building? Well, it matters because what Barry and Pugin created at Westminster didn't just rebuild, you know, Parliament. It reshaped an entire era. Before the Palace of Westminster, Gothic Revival was just a niche curiosity. You know, it was something romantics used for country chapels or the odd, you know, odd estate house or something like that. But after Westminster, pretty much everything changed. Gothic became the architectural language of the Victorian age. You know, if the seat of the British Empire, the very symbol of its power and identity and coolness, if that could be Gothic, you know, then pretty much anything could be Gothic. Town halls, train stations, universities, libraries, and then from there, homes across Britain and America eventually followed the lead. Barry and Pugin proved that you could take a medieval style, something old, and make it work for the modern world. You know, you could blend history and progress. You could honor the past while looking ahead to the future. And that balance, you know, nostalgia and innovation, reverence, reform, however you want to look at it, that balance became the heartbeat of Victorian design. And it's still something that we see in design today. But there's something deeper, too. Pugin brought a philosophy to Westminster that would echo through the century. You know, the belief that beauty and morality were connected, that good design could help make good people. Now, to him, ornament wasn't frivolous. It was meaningful. You know, every carved detail, every painted pattern, every curve and flourish was meant to lift the spirit, to remind people that beauty pointed towards something higher than themselves. And that conviction spread, and it became the soul of the Victorian home. It's why they filled their homes with pattern and color, why they covered every wall and every ceiling, why more, you know, wasn't just excess, it was virtue. They truly believed that living among beautiful, well-crafted things could make you a better person. And I love, 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 love that idea. I love digging into it because here's the thing. It's so easy to dismiss design and decoration and all of that as kind of shallow, you know, superfluous, super, oh, good grief. Super, what is that word? Superficial. Man, I'm sorry. Complete brain melt. Superficial. It's easy to dismiss, you know, design and decoration as shallow and superficial. You know, something that's not important, something that just makes our homes look nice and feel comfortable. But at the end of the day, it's not actually important. Right? It's easy to say that. You know, I catch myself thinking that way sometimes. And I've spent most of my working life in the paint industry. But still, sometimes it's easy to think that paint's just, you know, an afterthought. It's a finishing touch. You know, not something that really matters at the end of the day. But I think the Victorians were onto something. And it's not just them. I know that. It's not just them who had this thought, but they really brought it to the forefront. And I think they're onto something. And I'm not saying that painting your living room is going to make you morally superior. You know, that's not the argument at all. But what I am saying is that when we take the time to paint our homes, perhaps, or to choose colors that we love, to add touches that reflect who we are and who we want to be, we're making our homes better places to be in, better places to live in. And that is a moral good, isn't it? Isn't that a moral good? I think that's a moral good because the world out there is nuts sometimes. Not all the time, but sometimes it's nuts. Often it's nuts. And home is our retreat. You know, it's our haven. And making it feel welcoming and comfortable and peaceful, that's not just frivolous. It's necessary. It's good for us. It's good for the people we love. It's good for the kids that we're raising in that space. A beautifully painted and designed home doesn't raise your kids for you. Of course not. But it helps, you know, maybe a little bit, maybe a lot. Either way, it matters. You know, when the world feels chaotic, every bit of peace that we can create at home is definitely worth something. Every small choice to make our space better, even something as simple as a fresh coat of paint, all of that adds up. The Victorians understood that. They built it into their philosophy. Beauty isn't a luxury. It's part of what makes life livable. And I think they were right. And a good chunk of that philosophy that we're talking about came into being because of the work of Pugin and Barry and the legacy of their partnership. And remember, all of that started with a pile of burning sticks. All right, that's going to do it for this bonus episode of Home in Progress. If you enjoyed the show and you want to hear more content like this, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. And please, if you feel so inclined, share the show with a friend or two, or, you know, just leave us a review. All of those things will help other people find the show, and I really appreciate that. Thanks for listening. For Home in Progress, I'm Dan Hansen. I'll see you next time.